All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil, and the ones and twos. Sherry, I walked in here today to the studio thinking, let's talk some politics. And then I'm like, and you and I just decided.
Changes every hour.
Changes every hour. Let's take a break from it. I think people are a little fatigued by it. We're getting bombarded by ads and more ads and more ads on TV, Facebook.
I mean, to be fair, everyone should still read Cincinnati.com and read all the stories. Let's not get crazy. But we have a very special guest today.
Very special guest.
And we let's give all the time to this interview, I think.
Our special guest is the Reds president and chief operating officer, Phil Castellini. So we're really looking forward to having him on today. We'd asked during the season to see if we could get him on, and they said, hey, maybe after the season when things slow down a little bit. And so looking forward to having Phil come on. And I think
if they underestimated me, they were wrong, because like the day after the season ended, I'm like, hi, remember us?
So I think without further ado, let's jump to our special guest segment. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. And Sherry and I are a little extra excited today because we've been really trying to land this interview for a long time. Really pleased to welcome Cincinnati Reds president and chief operating officer, Phil Castellini. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm living the dream. And I can tell you my favorite part about confirming the meeting was when I confirmed with Shelley, my assistant this morning, that it was audio only.
That's Jason's favorite part, too.
That's mine, too. Anymore,
so I'm glad to be talking to you live and on the air versus I Zoom my life away the rest of the day. So this will be great.
Thank you so much for being here and taking the time. I know we've asked you a couple of times to be on, but it turns out you were really busy this year.
Yeah, it was crazy. And, you know, I do a whole lot of talking about the team and the business. I don't do a whole lot of time talking about myself. So that's probably one of the reasons it's been a little harder to nail me down.
That's okay. You're here now. And you know, I have a million questions for you, but we say that we like the podcast. You know, we want to get to know you a little bit because I feel like, you know, way back when we wrote about people's backstories and everything, but we don't do that in every single story. And plus we quote you mostly in serious stories. So let's go back to the beginning.
Great.
When you were growing up, what did you want to be?
So I grew up out in Glendale, which is a little village. I would always say it was kind of like a Norman Rockwell painting, a little village out by Tri-County, Princeton High School. Most of my friends went there. And I grew up playing a lot of sports, every sport that was available, but I was little. And so I played football, soccer, baseball, ice hockey, basketball, tennis, golf, every sport there was. I didn't have lacrosse back then, or I would have loved that sport. But the one I really excelled at, and the size I didn't grow up till I was in high school wasn't a problem, was tennis. And I probably took that the furthest. And for a long period of time, I would have told you I wanted to be a professional tennis player.
How good were you at baseball, though?
Not, again, I mean, when the kids got so much bigger than me that I got afraid to be in the batter's box against kids that could throw 80 miles an hour and I could probably hit, you know, 55. You know, so I wasn't bad at baseball. I was a switch hitter. I played first base. I was left-handed. You know, every lefty gets put at first base. But as it got bigger, the game got faster and kids could hit it and throw harder and faster. I just couldn't keep up. So there was never a part of me that saw myself being able to go further there. But I did excel at tennis, and that height size differential was a little bit mitigated for that sport. And again, you know, you start playing competitive tennis, just like competitive golf, even when you feel like you're really good, you realize there are a whole lot of kids that are really good at both of those sports. And so I didn't dream that dream for very long, but I would say that was the first one I did dream vis-a-vis a goal of being an athlete professionally.
Did your dad take you to all the games and like to the different things?
Yeah, you know what? Especially through late grade school into high school, I had my two older siblings went off to boarding school. And so I really went, we had season tickets at the Reds and Bengals. And at the time we were also involved in the Cincinnati Stingers growing up, the hockey team. So we went to every Stinger home game, and we went to as many Reds and baseball, Reds and Bengals games as we could. I got to go to the two Bengals Super Bowls. I went to the Ice Bowl, you know, that famous deep chill, you know, freezer playoff game against the Chargers. So a lot of growing up going to games with Dad, a lot of times just he and I, especially on the football front. So that was really special growing up. So we had a special connection to all of our local sports teams for sure.
That's a lot of sports history right there. I mean, those are like all of like the famous moments right there. And now you're going to be involved in other famous moments in your current job. Wow. So did you work in high school?
Yeah. And you had a question about, did I ever, you know, dream about this being a job? And the answer to that is crystal clear. Never. You know, we the family business is wholesale produce distribution, food processing, trucking, warehousing. So I grew up in Glendale riding my moped to work at, before I had a driver's license, I rode a moped from Glendale to Lockland on the back streets to cut cabbage at our salad processing plant. And then when I was old enough to drive, I would drive downtown to work on the docks of the produce company. And I did, this time of year, I would be doing Christmas trees from October through December and all the way through college, worked for the family businesses.
When you look out, like I've been in your offices before, and you look out over the banks and everything that's there, do you think about what the banks used to look like?
Oh, for sure. I spent my whole life down there. It was referred to as the bottoms, and all of those factories, rail lines, our produce companies went from the suspension bridge all the way to Central Avenue, and then on the west side all the way up Central Avenue to 3rd Street. So all of our, we had like four different operations down there. So Dad grew up on those, on the riverfront, as did myself. And then I was good friends with the Hatfield family. So one of my best friends is Ed Hatfield from Glendale, and his dad was Toby Hatfield. And there, that's their coal yard there on the riverfront as well. So my whole, you know, mine and Dad's history growing up was working down on those docks down in the bottoms. So yeah, we think about it all the time.
Can you tell me about the flood of 97? I heard you were working down there.
Oh, yeah. So I'm running that. It was called the Cincinnati Commercial Warehouse. It was a big 7-story brick warehouse. And it's the one, if you've been here a long time, it had the old neon Coke sign on top of it that you could see when you went across the 75 bridge. And the water started rising after like 2 straight weeks of rain, I think. And on a Monday, you had some puddles in the parking lot. By about lunchtime, it was 2 or 3 feet in the parking lot. And by 4 in the afternoon, the dock, a dock height where a box truck or a tractor trailer would back into, right? That's like 3 feet off the ground. We had water coming into the building, and we were evacuating. The rest of our staff got on the back of a truck to get out because the whole parking lot was already 4 feet underwater. And then that water stayed up for that whole week. And our engine room, that was a refrigerated warehouse on one end, was all refrigerated. And our engine room, the building was built to flood. And so the engine room was on the second floor. So we were still running the refrigeration and having to keep the building cold. But the only way we could get to the building, because the current was too strong, the first day we boated in. But then as the river kept rising, it got too strong to have that be safe. We cut a hole in the fence of the Clay Wade Bailey Bridge. We cut a hole in the fence and put a ladder down under the roof of the building, and that's how we got in and out to keep the refrigeration running.
I mean, so did you feel like at any time, like, you know, you're Bob Castellini's, you know, family, that you could maybe stay home and not do all of that kind of work?
Yeah, no, that's growing up, Dad worked 7 days a week, you know, 12 hours a day. There wasn't anything about, the only thing that you thought about if you were Bob Castellini's family is you were going to work as hard as he did. So at that time in my life, I'm down there with the guys keeping it running. We made a decision by Friday, the water was going to recede. Our guys hadn't worked for a week. It was a hourly union shop at the time. And I said, all right, guys, we can either bring in a third party company to like clean up and get rid of all the mud and silt from the river and clean our building up, which included offices that had 3 feet of water in them. So we had to cut drywall out and all that. Or we could get in here and just clean this building up ourselves. You guys haven't worked for a week. And that was a really fascinating time because that's what we did. And we had, you know, a forklift operator had a team of people helping clean up. And he had maybe it was the accountant and another clerk were on his cleanup. So it totally inverted the whole hierarchy as well. Right. So now all of a sudden you had hourly guys leading executives from the office because they're now part of a cleanup team. And it just really created a really interesting roll up your sleeves. We're all in it together culture. And we worked from Friday morning, 24 hours a day through Monday morning. And we reopened that building on for at least outbound product on that Monday after the flood. And it was just, it was amazing. I wouldn't wish a flood on anybody residentially or commercially, but it was a game changer for that one company, that small company called, which is now Merchants Cold Storage, located out in Richwood, Kentucky. But pretty wild experience. But all the work I had done up to that point, I think, had me better prepared to handle the labor intensive nature of what that really looked like operationally.
So, I mean, I do think like moments like that define us. Like, it's the tough moments. You don't know in the moment that is like a life-defining moment. But then on the other side of it, you realize. And I also am a big believer in, like, you get your work ethic from your parents. You know, I had parents that were public school teachers, and they went to work every day. We weren't sick in our house. You could always go to school. Yeah. You could always go to work. And I do believe in that kind of work ethic is passed down in families. Okay.
No question about it. And I think as you evolve, as my career has, and get more of a leadership role at different, you know, types of businesses, and certainly the Reds being totally out of the box, you're better able to understand the tasks and duties and mentalities of people throughout an entire organization from the ground up. And if you're raised in the executive office and you always live in the executive office and you never went down to the kind of production floor, so to speak, you have a hard time relating to that whole spectrum. And so that I would argue is the biggest benefit of working in and up through any company, whether it's a family company or not. That perspective, I think, is really important later in one's career if you continue to do more to manage people and processes.
So Phil, you talked about growing up. So how did you morph into the job that you're doing today? And obviously your dad owns the team, and can you talk about, you know, the evolution of your role and how you came into it?
Yeah, no problem. I think there's an interesting background to that I'm not sure a lot of people know all the connected dots to. So there was a group of guys, the Williams family, DeWitts and Reynolds, ourselves, you know, and a few others. They built the Coliseum and owned and operated the Heekins is the one I left out, and owned and operated the Cincinnati Stingers. And so that was our first foray into like being engaged in a sports team, hockey back then. Remember, that was before the NHL, you know, they merged the different leagues into the one, and the Stingers didn't make the cut in the end. But
WHL?
So that was a fascinating thing to grow up with, and went to every home game. And as such, went to every concert, every event that ever came through the Coliseum. So that was a really neat thing to have growing up. And Bill DeWitt, as you know, his dad and W.J. Williams were both involved in owning the Reds back in the 60s and 70s. So as time evolved and I got older and was into, you know, high school and whatnot, Bill had a desire to get back into baseball. And he had a group of Cincinnati families that followed him through that goal, and that went from the Texas Rangers to the Baltimore Orioles. Neither time were anybody in the group anything but limited partners, not the lead operating partner. And then he finally had a chance to buy the Cardinals, which he did, and that made Bill the lead guy running the team. And he had family from St. Louis, his wife's from St. Louis. And so for 10 years, dad was the second largest owner in the interest in a limited partner capacity in the Cardinals. And that's when we really became more students of the game and the operations and ownership, certainly through the other two experiences as well in Texas and in Baltimore. Baltimore was like a short 2-year period. And so that 10 years for, but we were still limited partners, but as you can imagine, so now we're talking about, like 95, 96 to 2005, 2006, you know, Bill, his son, Bill, the third, they've just done a great job with that franchise. And they had a lot of postseason, appearances during that time. And we had a lot of fun doing that. The Mark McGuire, Sammy Sosa, we were still engaged during that year. That was a wild summer and, a lot of playoffs, had a lot of fun doing that. But, you know, it was always weird. At this point, I'm out of college. I'm working for the warehouse company. We have season tickets for the Reds and I'd be taking customers to a game and we'd be playing the Cardinals and, you know, something would happen in the game and I'd be like, yes, I mean, no, I mean, yes, you know, I'm so conflicted, you know? So, but we had a lot of fun doing that. And fast forward to when 05 came and, Bill and his group from Cincinnati was asked by the Reds ownership group if they had interest in looking to do it. This is March of 05. Well, Bill was in the process of building the new ballpark in St. Louis. They had just had 10 years of success. Like I said, his son Bill was in there with him. He had other family members working for the team. Like I said, they were going to open the stadium in 06. The timing just didn't work. So the entire group passed on the opportunity to do the diligence to buy the Reds because Dad never wanted to be the lead guy. We just all thought we'd follow Bill.
Yeah.
You know, and he did have a goal when he started to eventually get back and buy the Reds. But the timing just didn't work. And so we passed on the opportunity. Fast forward to August of 05.
How old were you then?
I'm 25.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Let's see. Of 05, 35. Sorry. I'm 35. And Dad sees an article in the paper that the final three bidders on the team. So now they've all been doing their research and diligence on buying the team and bidding on the team for 6 months. None of the groups are from Cincinnati. And he's like, wait a second, we can't have somebody buy the Reds that's not from Cincinnati. Because if you remember back in 05, there's still talk of you could pick up a team and move them somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's certainly something we never want to see happen. So long story short, he gets a hold of Tom and Joe Williams and says, hey, guys, what do you think about, you know, putting in a bid for the team? And he saw Mr. Linder at a game sometime in that August, maybe late August, and said, hey, what would you think if we threw our hat in the ring quickly? And he said, well, that's great, but the final bids on the team are due in the next 2 weeks. And everybody else has been doing their homework since March. So we asked for a 2-week extension, which was granted. And we wound up doing all the research and getting a handshake to buy that team in 30 days.
Wow.
And that 30 days looked like a scene out of a movie with the all-nighters and pizza boxes. And you know, because we could go to the stadium and they'd let us look at all the data, but you weren't allowed to take anything with you. And then we'd go back to Dad's office and Dick came up from Atlanta and we had their CFO, our CFO, the Williams North American Properties CFO, our CFO, our attorney, their attorney. And we would all just, you know, grind it out in the boardroom, crunching numbers, trying to put a qualified bid together. It was pretty wild ride.
How long did you have to wait between the bid and finding out that you won?
So it wound up being from about mid to late November until mid January, because you have that ownership transfer has to be an in-person quarterly meeting that's voted on by all the owners. So we had to wait, probably 6-8 weeks to actually close on and get control of the team.
I still,
and then it's mid January and you know, you're, what, 2.5 months away from opening day and drinking out of a fire hose.
I think probably a lot of Reds fans do, and you as well, remember your dad very strongly saying, we're going to bring championship baseball back to Cincinnati. That was a pretty powerful moment, I thought.
Yeah, that's still the plan.
He's a guy who he was competitive. And he meant it to the core.
Yeah.
How much does it bug him that hasn't happened yet?
You know, and this is, you know, somewhat, we are now way more educated on the realities of our industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this isn't meant to be an excuse or to complain. It's just it's just kind of a mathematical reality. The small market, large market thing has always been a challenge. I think it's been a challenge for most sports. You know, I think salary caps and equally spreading TV revenues and some of the things that have been done along the way and some of the other sports help create a more competitive balance. But the economic challenges in this game and the gap in top line between the big and small markets just continues to create a really challenging competitive environment. Now, that being said, that just means markets like ours. And look, you got, you know, the Rays in the World Series as we speak against the highest paid team, you know, the best team money can buy. And, you know, you got to roll up your sleeves and grow your own and be creative and work harder and smarter. But, you know, we're much more attuned to the realities of that challenge today than certainly we were back in 05, 06. It doesn't mean we're going to try any less hard or we have less passion to bring the city and region of, and, you know, what we call Reds country, that championship. But we're certainly more attuned to the realities of how difficult that is in the current environment of this particular game.
Do you ever watch a game with your dad?
Oh, all the time.
Okay.
I'm at every home game, as is he. So depending on who he's hosting and entertaining, I wouldn't say it's every game because do the math in the last 5 years. I mean, sometimes by the you know, third inning, you don't want to be anywhere near dad, depending on how the game's going. But yeah, all the time.
What is he like during a game? Like what?
Every pitch, every out, every at bat, it is an emotional roller coaster.
Really?
He is. You could not have anybody more dialed in than he is.
Wow. That's intense.
And we keep trying to tell him, you know, it's a long season, relax, whatever. But that's just the way he is. That's the way he is in life and business. And certainly in this application, that's just his DNA. And it's, you know, I don't think it's that great for his health, but that's just the way the guy is wired. And, you know, it's a great passion and hopefully it's contagious, you know?
Yeah. It's intense.
I mean, this was supposed to be like this huge year when, I mean, we had so much hype going into things before the pandemic hit. Were you kind of watching as that hype was building? What did you think about, you know, the rallying cry?
I mean, we were a baseball town all year leading up
to the pandemic.
Look, I think on paper, I wouldn't call it hype because a lot of times hype is, you need to hype it because it isn't going to live up to it, right? That's like
true.
In this case, I think it was well-founded enthusiasm and confidence in what team had been built on paper. So you knew the pitching was there. We had certainly appeared to have improved the hitting. And just as an example, you know, Moustakas has been a huge addition, but between some, you know, COVID stuff and some injury stuff, you didn't get him all 60 games. You don't, you know, I think the year Suarez had, if we look back at his career and we're cutting a ribbon for him to be in the Hall of Fame, however long from the Reds Hall of Fame, however long from now, if he has the kind of career we think he should have, this year is going to show up a little bit like a blip on his lifetime radar. You know what I mean? So you don't necessarily expect that to happen. You know, a couple other things, certainly you hoped guys would be more offensively productive than they were. But so I don't think it was unfounded optimism in what that team had the capability to do. Certainly, especially midseason, it was a head scratcher for all of us. You had, you know, and how long we lost Senzel and some other things. So, you know, certainly it wasn't the storybook that you hoped it would be. Then they had the surge at the end. So now you're like, okay, maybe it was a little slow start, but here we go. This is what we all expected. We beat a lot of great teams going towards the end of that regular season. And we get big opportunities in the postseason. I think if you've watched what Atlanta has done, and I, you know, if not for, in my opinion, a bit of a running gaffe on the bases, that you know, I think that probably cost them certainly that game, if not the series.
Yeah.
You weren't going to keep the Dodgers asleep all seven games. But, you know, I really think Atlanta played good enough to win that series. And when you look back at how well we kept them, those bats at bay for those at least a game and a half anyway. You know, we had a shot to get that one too, and it's hard to tell, you know, how far much further that team could have gone. But I felt there was a momentum building. I felt had we taken a little more advantage of that first inning of game one, I think that momentum would have continued. I think having grinded through that whole first game, I will tell you, you know, there's just a pit in my stomach that That just seemed, you could just kind of feel like it was reverting back to something other than a storybook. And again, yeah. You can't keep Atlanta down for 18 innings in a row. And so, of course, that second game, I think, should have been the split, right? And then we would have been playing a third game, and it would have been interesting to see what happened there. So, you know, certainly a disappointment, but I think that the team was there. Obviously a goofy year, not the same way to prep for it with a solid spring training and all the different crazy stuff. But guess what? Every team went through all those same challenges, right? So I think we still have a great foundation on which to continue to build out this team. And I think we're as enthusiastic about 21 as we were 20. And, you know, we just got to take it a day at a time and see what happens this offseason. There's some chess pieces going to move around, but we're still pretty enthusiastic about next year as well.
This is the portion of the podcast where you're supposed to make big news and tell us all the players that are coming and all the secrets. They come out right now.
Let me remind the audience, I'm in charge of business operations and the fan experience.
Do you ever have a say in trades or free agent signings? Does anyone ever ask your take, or do you give your?
I would say it's a seat at the table without necessarily a tie shifting vote, as it were, because we got plenty of guys that do that 24/7, and certainly all that flows through Dad, and that, you know, that committee of the ultimate decision making is really made up of the baseball leadership guys and Dad. Mm. But the good news is, you know, there's a handful of us on the business side, myself in particular, and our CFO and in-house legal counsel. So Doug Healy and Jim Marks are both kind of baseball quants to begin with. And so I would say, especially over the last 5, 6, 7 years, you know, when we are in a group setting, all of those opinions are asked, and we do have dialogue. But again, ultimately, the decisions are made by the guys that are doing it every day.
When did you realize, because you do talk like the business side, that's the pandemic side almost. Like, when did you realize that it was, I mean, for us, it feels like it was overnight. It was like election, that was some craziness. And it was like 1 minute, it was like, well, it's not here. And the next minute it was. When did you realize that it was going to impact everything that baseball does?
Great question. And it was a pretty quick epiphany. So we're out at spring training. We've just had our owners meeting that we have once a year out there with our limited partner owners. And then following that was our corporate sponsorship trip, and it just starts to come out as being a thing. But you know, you also thought maybe it's just going to be something that kind of floats through quickly. But I remember we had a last event that had players interacting with our owners. We decided to do that, but we pulled back from one of the events that was supposed to happen with sponsors just because now all of a sudden it's looking, you know, sketchy, and we want to keep the players separated from the public. It was the beginning of the bubble talk, right? And I remember we're at the hotel at the Wigwam out there in Goodyear, Arizona, and the last night, like our banquet dinner for our sponsors, I remember giving a little talk at the end, and I said, and here we all go to return to Cincinnati, and this is probably the last normal thing we'll do for a couple of months, was my comment. And that couldn't have been more true. So we return to Cincinnati. I think that was like on a Sunday, Monday. And this is what's hilarious. That Wednesday, I had the entire staff, everybody in the front office that was in Cincinnati, I had them all in classroom style in rows for us to watch that week's telecast of DeWine's, you know, the
press
governor's
conferences.
Update.
Yeah.
And it was when I believe it was that Wednesday where he was basically shutting down the schools and, you know, basically the first round of shutting down the state for protocol reasons. And literally by that Friday, we had sent everybody home. And even then, it's like 4, 6 weeks, maybe, you know, kind of, well, you know, we were still talking about, you know, maybe you have to lose the first 2 weeks of the season kind of thing, and then we'll get back at it. And then now we're talking about what? We're at the end of March. And by the end of February – no, wait, March. I'm sorry. By the end of March, we knew we were losing 2 weeks of the season, but we had not conceded to the full first month. And I would say by mid-March, I could tell you you know, we were talking about losing the whole season. And then the whole saga started to play out with the whole Players Association, MLB front office drama. That all played itself out in the media. As you guys know as much about that as I do. And I would say that was the time when it was very crystal clear. Not only was this going to be a major issue for 2020, and we might be lucky to get 60, 80 games, but this thing's going to go on well into 21 as well. And I think we all understand that's just a reality for, you know, certainly the country, if not planet Earth at this point.
Were you ever after the 60-game season began, were you ever – well, number one, did you think that you were going to have fans? And if so, when did you realize it was not going to happen?
Yeah, other good question. So originally I'm like, look, if we're not going to have fans, I'd just soon not do that for the balance of the season, because immediately I when you started to do the math on the 6-foot social distancing, that math solves for about 25% capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Those economics don't work. You can't afford to operate any business at 20% capacity. I don't care what it is, right? And so for me, I'm like, I'd rather leave it turned off till I can turn it back on, right? Mm. And so we had kind of conceded the season, and then especially as more time went on, that they were sticking to that, and then even coming out with even lower numbers, like maybe we'll let you have 1,500 or 6,000 or whatever. But somewhere about, I don't know, June-ish, we started to say, look, this thing is going to go into 21. It's not going to turn off like a switch, and we should go ahead and submit a plan for fans after, you know, kind of after the mid season, because we need to get some experience for operating the ballpark post COVID. So we went ahead and submitted a plan, got it approved by the city, the county. And that's when the state came out, and they've been great to work with, but they came out for our venues, as you know, the Bengals and Browns, and basically said much smaller numbers than we had presented. And, you know, by the time we got the plans approved and by the time we pulled the trigger, I could have had maybe 1,500 to 3,000 fans for like 3 games.
Yeah.
And so in the end, we just punted. But and for example, we've got some of our operations employees going to go spend the day with the Bengals operations staff this Sunday to do a walkthrough with them and just kind of benchmark what that looks like. And I think they're going for that 12,000-13,000. This weekend, I believe, at Paul Brown. So we're just really continuing to do the benchmarking and gear up for, you know, we're going to resubmit for a higher number because our number was about 9,000 to 10,000. We're going to resubmit a kind of a 2.0 at maybe closer to 30%, which will be about 13,000 or 14,000, you know, in the off season and see how that goes. But, you know, that's a long answer to the question, but that's kind of how it evolved.
Are you resigned to the fact that you're going to start next season with limited capacity? Or, I mean, I know obviously it's day to day, but are you at that point?
I don't see enough data supporting the fact that I shouldn't be in that mindset. Right.
Yeah.
What I would prefer is, hey, turn off the protocols. Cause at the end of the day, let the consumer decide. Right. I've been on a lot of task forces for restart and whatnot and large venues. And my theory is we, the operators, are going to have to show you a COVID safe park, number one, which is going to include most of the social distancing protocols. But, you know, even without the protocols, these buildings are going to empty themselves by fan interest. The average age of my fan is 56 years old. So you can imagine that goes up and it goes all the way down to families with kids. So, you know, even if I had no regulations, I'm going to have a change in my consumption just by the nature of people's comfort level with going out to large venues with a lot of people. So, I think when you add the structural limitations to it, it just kind of hammers that point home more. I think as a country, as a society, certainly our economic business environment, we have to learn to live with COVID, not hide from it. And the longer we hide from it, the deeper we'll take our country and our cities and states into, you know, you're going to go from economic recessions to depressions. You know, it's just, we got to figure out how to turn the machine back on and keep each other safe.
So as we sit here today, looking ahead, opening day, short of normal times, opening days jam-packed, you are hoping for an opening day that has at least 13,000 fans inside the state.
I'm hoping for somewhere like 50%, but I think relevant to the realities of the processes, where the vaccine will be, how many people are taking it. You know, you all have just come out of that kind of winter flu, cold and flu season spike. You know, I think it's going to start lower and build in my capability to have higher attendance as the season goes on. But I don't have enough reasons to be optimistic about, you know, a 50% capacity by opening day, at least. I think maybe by the All-Star break or something, that seems more reasonable. But, you know, I just, like I said, if you have to operate the way CDC is defining the 6 feet as the requirement, that's just how the math works and how you orient a building. So,
how about the opening day parade? Any optimistic?
Huge question. You know, you could certainly educate people how to spread it out. You could spread out the space between the bands, floats, all the different things that are associated with it. One of the things we've kind of had a conversation about, and I haven't talked with Neil Lucan at Finley Market about this for several months at this point. There's something about, are you better off punting on an event and waiting to bring it back the way everybody's used to consuming it, rather than bringing it back in this candy-coated, super weird COVID way that it just is going to be kind of a letdown? And I would tell you the answer to that question that we asked ourselves starting with Reds Fest was, I'd rather wait for Reds Fest and do it the way we know how to do it and the way the fans like to consume it than to have everybody walking around in bubble suits or whatever the heck I'd have to do to pull it off in December. You know what I mean? So I'm not sure where the Finley Market folks will be feeling by then, but you know, I think it's a huge wild card at this point.
I mean, it must be so difficult because I think you would start planning those things now, but I think everyone's lives, it's like you have a plan this week and then next week is a different plan and the next week. I mean, how close do you follow, you find yourself following like all of the medical things related to
COVID? From about March, 20th all the way through the season, it was every single day, every single stat you could consume. I turned that switch off a couple weeks ago, but it's hard not to. And I just picked it back up. Unfortunately, last night I was dialed into some of the stats that were coming out in an article about, you know, we're starting to be leaning towards being a red zone again. So it's hard to avoid it for too long.
So you had another difficult moment during everything this season. As our listeners know, Tom Brenneman resigned after being caught on a hot mic. And I was wondering how difficult, has that been for you, the decisions that had to be made and him choosing to leave?
Yeah, and look, this speaks to the credibility of Tom, the man. And, you know, these are things that just happen. This guy's been doing this for 33 years. He's as good as anybody in the business, in my opinion. It was just an all-around tragic situation. It's something that shouldn't be thought, much less said out loud. Tom knows that. We all know that. As an organization and working with Fox, look, in today's day and age, it's just kind of a zero-tolerance approach to that. That's just not something you can have associated with your organization. And so he knew exactly what the organization had to do and why, and which is also why, you know, we were at the end of a contract year and, as you know, was suspended for the balance of the year we had. And that's when he came to us and said, look, I think I need to move on and do this, repair my own damage done. And he's done a ton of that and is making a lot of great relationships. And he's certainly had an eye-opening, soul-searching experience of his own. And I know his family's happy to get him back off the road and have a little bit more time with them as well. And you will see Tom, back in a broadcast booth. And at the end of the day, too, the other thing that people didn't realize as well is Tom, with his football, never did a full season schedule, and neither did Marty. So we have been talking for several years about our desire to get back to having two guys in the radio booth and two guys in the TV. And so that's been a desire of ours on the business side for years. And so, one of the things in this chapter – turning of the page is you're going to see us bring in a new play-by-play and kind of have this two booths a little bit more solidified with a team on each side of on each medium. Because as you know, any given season, we're running 6-8 different people through our broadcasts. And it, trust me, it's difficult to manage and schedule. And, you know, so that's one of the things we hope to move forward. And I just, you know, the Brennemans have been such an amazing part of the Reds' history and experience. You know, we'll be inducting his dad into the Hall of Fame next year. You'll definitely see Tom be a part of that ceremony and event. And it's just, it was a very challenging, difficult time, but obviously way more challenging for Tom than the franchise. You know, the playbook for what the franchise needs to do in that equation is pretty simple. And one of the things I told a lot of people about, including my own kids asking me about it, is I told the story of Howard Cosell and what happened at the end of his career. I don't know if either of you know that story. Same thing in this kind of passion moment, a very different circumstance. He was calling a live part of the game, but he made a comment that you just can't make. And it effectively was a kind of a quick end to a long and heroic career of a guy like Howard Cosell. So it's just one of these things you hate to see happen, especially to a consummate professional like Tom, but it did. And as a result, everybody had to move forward and do the right things. And I think we as an organization did. And I certainly think Tom as a man has and will continue to do.
Phil, you said you think Tom will at some point be back in the booth. Do you see that potentially with the Cincinnati Reds, or do you mean for another franchise?
Likely not. I just mean as a broadcaster, because the guy can do any sport. He could do Olympics. Yeah. He could do whatever he wants. You know, he's got that kind of talent. As I just stated, we'll be, you know, filling that slot on our side of the equation. So it's not altogether likely in any near term, just because we will have filled the chair with new talent. And hopefully we pick, you know, choose wisely and have someone that is going to be here for a long time. So, but I do think, again, I think it'll do him well to have some time off and, you know, get a few things sorted out. But yeah, I absolutely expect that we will all see Tom somewhere again as a broadcaster of live sports, for sure.
Will you go outside to hire the new play-by-play person, or does Jim Day have a shot at it?
Jim Day has been amazing. He's been amazing filling guys. You know, we used to call it the quilt of how we patch in. You know, we need a guy for 6 games here and 10 games there and all that. And Jim has been amazing. But we think Jim's best slot is being the entertainer that he is and the relationships he has with the guys. That sideline guy, that desk guy, I mean, he built that post-game, you know, table-banging crowd, live crowd experience, post-game show down at Great American. And so that's really his sweet spot, and we continue to want to have him get back to that sweet spot. But you will continue to see us use Jim, and he just did a tremendous job through the end of the season.
Yeah,
so,
he did.
But again, I think that's his strength, so we want to get him back to where his strength is. And like I said, we've been interviewing and looking at videos of a bunch of, you know, career play-by-play folks, and hopefully, you know, within the next 30 days or so, we will have gotten closer to having an announcement to make about who might be next.
So thinking that that's like one of the most difficult moments, you know, in the job that you have, tell us some of the greatest moments.
Well, you know, that's a great question. So hosting the civil rights games were awesome. And we really put that event on the map at the league level, and the kind of celebrity talent that we brought in and really bridged that gap between sports and that social conscience and justice. You know, and that was back, you know, in 2010 and whatnot. The All-Star game was an amazing experience to host that. Certainly anything associated with any postseason, Jay Bruce is probably the biggest highlight, because it was the first accomplishment, the walk-off win. Bronson was already planning to have a party for the players. I planned a party for the staff. I got to go to my first champagne drenching celebration. I go up to before the Handlebar was just the Champions Club. Our whole front office staff is up there, and then we got to go to the party up in Fountain Square where the players were. My wife's 8 months pregnant. I've got her out till like 2 a.m. You know, it was just, so
you
that
can't
one
drink
for
champagne,
sure,
but you could
out.
Wear it.
Exactly. So, you know, that certainly is one that stood out. All of the different clinching playoff You know, appearances were all great. You know, any one-offs, another one that sticks out, you know, a comeback, Adam Dunn, Grand Slam, home run, you know, just kind of randomly in the middle of the season. I think it might have been back in that 2010 season. But, you know, those were some of the things that stick out. And you know, one of the things that I've grown to appreciate and why I bring up things like Civil Rights Game, the opening of the Urban Youth Academy, the All-Star Game is, we have understood from day one that taking this team on to operate it is about being stewards of a community asset. And we have never looked at it any other way. And so what we on the business side can do consistently is deliver the best game experience we can, continue to improve the ballpark to make those fan experiences better, and do what we can to always put the franchise and the city in the best national spotlight that we can. And so one of the things that I really get enjoyment out of is the things that do that, like hosting an All-Star game, because it's a way to put Cincinnati on the map. It's a way for us to be proud of what we do as a city and where we are. You know, celebrating the 150 for all of last year was amazing. Just to remind all of us the history of this city, the history of this team, what we have to be proud of. And it transcends all of the winning and losing and the evolution of good and bad teams, you know, productive and not so productive seasons. And if you stay focused on the bigger picture, stewardship, and always continuing to do what you can for the community, it kind of helps you weather the storm of what's not so fun when you're 15 games back and you got more people working at the stadium than at the game in late September. You know, I tell people, you know, the shine can work. You know, come off the penny pretty quick when you're, you know, you're still in the business, just like you are on opening day for a huge parade and a sunny day and a sellout and the place is going wild. You know what I mean? So you got to be prepared for all of those different experiences. But it's been an awesome ride and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
I mean, I was just down in Lower Price Hill to write some stories about affordable housing. I mean, and I saw the community garden you did several years ago there. I mean, just the projects they outlast just the moment that, you know, the Reds sweep in and do a project in our communities. There are these lasting projects that make a difference to people. And when I was down there, like, people were just working in the garden. It was just there, and it wasn't just there for a photo op or, you know, that was something, oh, the team did this year. This was several years later. People, I mean, the garden is huge and blooming.
That's exactly right. And the only way those things happen are through partnership and collaboration. You know, if we were the only ones doing that stuff, you know, P&G started with the community makeover over 10 years ago. Kroger jumped on board. The Cincinnati Zoo jumped on board. Children's Hospitals jumped on board, depending on where the specific projects are. And then we also made sure that there's a nonprofit, some kind of a community agency that in the most recent projects that is playing the role to carry on the health and use of those projects moving forward, so that you don't have something that just looks good for a year and nobody, you know, maintains or activates, and it loses its benefit of the investment that was made by that collaborative team. And so we've really put a pretty neat model together along those lines. And that's why you're able to look at something like that years later and still see it going. So it's all about that collaboration and what we can do as a community when we all band together. You know, the fist is stronger than any individual finger. And that's really, you know, that's been part of the magic of participating in operating this team, a community asset. And Charlie Frank and his group do such a great job, and what they do in the baseball and softball outreach in the community. And again, partners like P&G and Kroger and Zoo and others have made all of that stuff possible over the last decade.
The commitment from the Reds Community Fund to the community, and as Sherry said, you know, you go to Lower Price Hill. This is back in the summer. I was driving around when I was in Reading for something, and I look over and there's a Reds ball field there. The Academy is just unbelievable in Bond Hill. This is a commitment the ownerships of the Reds had never made until your dad and the ownership group currently came along. Was that a big part of taking on the ownership of the organization? Is like, we're not just going to own the team, we're going to immerse it into the community and give back?
Yeah, and to be fair, the Reds Community Fund existed before we got there.
It did, okay.
And but I would say it was kind of a sidecar, right? I think what we did is made it an intentional pillar of focus. They used to put out $200,000 or $300,000 a year, and now we're doing well over $2 million a year in community outreach. Awesome. We have created revenue streams dedicated to the community fund, like our game used authentics, split the pot, some of those things that we're doing. And again, Charlie has built his staff and built partnerships to broaden the scope of what they do. And one key difference, I'll go back to the Cardinal experience. The Cardinals have a nonprofit called Cardinal Care, and their model, they would do a bunch of different events and whatnot, and they still do activations of softball and baseball in the community. But their model is they'd raise a bunch of money, and then they'd give that money to a bunch of nonprofits in town that were focused on any number of different things. And the key difference that in our model of when we took over the team and how are we going to do the outreach, Dad is involved in all kinds of things all over the city, all kinds of nonprofits. There's great nonprofits on almost every spectrum where there needs to be a service or something provided or filled in or take care of someone or something left behind, right? And so his goal wasn't to try to conquer the universe in terms of community need and outreach. It was to focus it specifically on connecting this game and the power that this game has to connect communities, get kids off the couch and onto the ball field. The match program pairs up, you know, white neighborhoods with African-American neighborhoods. You mix the kids up. And, you know, so it was very centric. And that was the one priority, is we're going to make it 100% baseball and softball focused, build character and community and whatnot, but to narrow the focus and have the link be through and to the sport. And that's why we've been able to grow it so specifically in the arenas that you see. And only recently, and with PNG, do you see those projects include renovating a community center connected to a field project, the hoop houses, the gardens. Those are all things that came with the additional partners of PNG and Kroger and the zoo and others, Tool Bank and whatnot. So that's really, as we built out that, we added to what that mission and outreach of the community fund was, but only because of the partnerships.
Okay, so I know all of the Reds Community Fund are secret. So I look forward to what next year's is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. So am I. I just it's just so bizarre. You can't do them in the format we normally do. So yeah, stay tuned.
Okay, so a couple fun questions. We do like to do this at the end sometimes. I heard that you picked up a nickname at the All-Star Game.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Marla Miller at the league. The minister of shenanigans.
I mean, that to me is the best nickname ever. How'd you get that nickname?
So Marla Miller runs all of the league events at MLB, and she's been there for 30 plus years. So all-star games, playoffs, owner meetings, you name it. And so she would be the one to come in and facilitate. And Marla is an amazing woman, but she is old school New York, hardcore, like you don't mess with Marla. And you know, you bring my show into that room, and it didn't take long for her to figure out that I was going to be a project for her to manage. But it also didn't take long for her to figure out, look, we just want to make it better and have some fun. And we have had an amazing relationship for years, and she's one of the best. For example, at the end of the season, she was somewhere and found a mask that had a handlebar mustache on it and sent it to me with a little note. So we've had a great relationship, but that's where that came from. And certainly everybody has some fun with that in our office anyway.
I mean, you have to, if you have to seize on that. I can see that. You're a big Grateful Dead fan. Is that right?
Yeah. That was kind of our thing. A lot of my buddies growing up like video games and poker, and I like seeing live music. And so I went to college in New England in Boston, and you know, bands like Fish coming out of New England, Blues Traveler coming out of New York, and you know, tons of great bands in Boston with the Berklee School of Music there, and you know, the great, you know, it was bands that write and play their own music and actually play instruments, right? You know, so kind of the jam bands was our lane, and certainly the Dead was one of the inspirations for that. And we would see them when they came through the East Coast, and Allman Brothers, you name it, any of those, live bands that don't play just 2-minute long songs, was what we're into. So that's really what I did all the way through and after college. And that's just what my group of friends likes to do, see live music and play it as well. We got a lot of buddies that are musicians. I got a jam room at the house. So that's been a passion for a long time.
What do you play?
Percussion.
Do you have do you ever play anywhere? I mean, I feel like you have a gigantic stadium and you could have your own concert.
Well, no. So have you ever heard of Swamp Thing, a local band that plays a lot of charity gigs? If you've ever been to one of those, that was a band led by Alan Zering and his brother Mark. And so I was in that while. Like I said, we played charity gigs because we basically played for free, right? And so, yeah, I did that for about a year until that got to be more time doing that than my wife was happy with five kids at home. So, but those guys are still out there doing that.
Did you, when did you pick up playing the drums at a young age or
in college?
Yeah.
I was a lefty, right? So I took piano lessons as a kid. I hated that. Anytime I picked up a guitar, it was a right-handed guitar. Nothing was comfortable.
Yeah.
I'd sit down at a drum set. And I don't know if you know this, but you set up a drum set exactly opposite of how you set it up for a right-hander. And so that was never comfortable. And in college, I bought my roommate a set of bongos for his birthday. And he was terrible at them. He had nothing like buying a guy with no rhythm some bongos. And so they were just laying around, and I started goofing around on those. And I had rhythm. I just never, like I said, I didn't realize how much of a factor that whole lefty-righty thing was. So all my percussion was, you know, on those, you know, hand drums, congas, bongos, that kind of stuff. And joined a band with Alan in college for, you know, giggles. And then we did a little bit of that after college. But, yeah, that's about as far as it ever went. Hobby at best.
Everybody needs a backup job.
Yeah, you know, I'd be more like one of those bucket boys probably than you'd see me, at some place you had to pay for a ticket for. But either way, we had fun doing it.
What's your absolute? If you're a fan, you are a fan, but it's your life and your job. But let's say you're going to a game just as a fan. What is your What is the absolute ballpark food that you have to have?
Oh, at our ballpark, so we stole a concept from the Cardinals. So August Busch, that owned, obviously, Anheuser-Busch, the team, the stadium, and his owner's suite was called the Redbird Roost in St. Louis. And he had a little 4'10" woman in there named Fanny. And August Busch loved the White Castle hamburgers. No, wait, I'm sorry. Steak and shake.
Yeah.
Right. And so he had them put a griddle in the back in a kitchen connected to the suite. And she would make these little hand slap teeny bun burgers, not like sliders, but, you know,
real thin
huge,
burgers,
not huge, like kind of that medium one. Right.
Yeah.
And either cheese or no cheese. And she'd bring them out, you know, in trays at a time. And I mean, when you went to St. Louis, and if you had access to that owner suite, to the Redbird Roost, they were called Fanny Burgers, and you had to have a Fanny Burger. So when we came to the Reds, DNC runs that park as they do ours. And so we thought we needed to like crack the code for the secret recipe of the Fanny Burger. It just wound up being 80-20 ground beef with a lot of salt and pepper. But, you know, we brought that back and have Scotty Burgers at the ballpark, but only in a couple of individual areas, the owner's suite, dad's suite. So we don't sell them anywhere in the park because we brought in Frisch's in Penn Station and we've done a lot of other things. So it never made it to retail. But that's my go-to at the park in terms of what I like to do, and just giving you a little background where
that's
tradition
great.
Came from.
That's so cool. Did August Busch like to drink beer?
I sure hope so. Man, he would have been one frustrated operator.
Maybe a stupid question. If he liked a beer with his Fanny Burger.
I would think so. They certainly had a lot of taps in that suite, I can tell you that much.
Did they?
Do you do something like after a season ends, like I'm just going to take a minute, or is it just like it's right on to the next thing?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I get that asked all the time. What are you going to do in the off season? And my answer from the business side is, I don't know. I'll let you know when I find one. Because one fun thing we do, we play a staff softball game on the field at some point in October, depending on when it ends, right? And we're actually going to do that because we've had a lot of folks furloughed. We're doing that November 2nd this year because we're bringing the furloughed group back after November 1st. But in the business, you have to – all the stadium projects we do – you have to budget, you have to design, budget for, and you are building those out between basically December 1st and April 1st. All the season tickets have to be resold, all the corporate sponsorships. So it's as busy in the off season on our side of the business as it is in season, just minus the game events. We do Reds Fest. We do Caravan traditionally, you know, Reds Fest January or December first week, Caravan third week of January. Next thing you know, you're out there in spring training. So there really isn't much of an off. You just take the live game events off the table for a couple months.
This is great stuff, Phil. Really appreciate you taking some time today and just sharing all these great stories. And the one thing about baseball is, and I think you've attested to it here today, is that it's the stories that make it such a wonderful game.
It really is. And, you know, if I had to tell you one of my favorite, not a moment, but we'll wrap with this because I've got the best job on the planet. I've got the best employees on the planet. I enjoy what I do every day. But my office looks right out there onto the Joe Morgan statue. Mm. And watching fans come in and watching the multi-generational fans and that kid that stops with his little cardboard camera that his mom bought him at the drugstore, and he's taking a picture of a statue or that mural on the side of our building, and they're starry-eyed, maybe coming to their first game, and there you see multi-generations of fans, or, you know, when they're walking the dogs in on our Bark in the Park days. I'm blessed to get reminded every day why we do what we do, and it's all about the fans, and we love the support, and, you know, we're going to work through all this COVID stuff and hopefully get back to normal and continue to put a contender on the field and do what we can to get another trophy back into Cincinnati. So let's all hope and pray for that. And everybody stay safe and go Redlegs.